So this is for you. Yes, you. The person that's been wanting to sign up for Breathe to Heal but still hasn't yet. Consider this your aggressive yet loving nudge towards something that's actually going to have a huge impact on the way you show up in the year ahead. And here is why. You will gain practical nervous system tools that you can actually lean on whenever you find yourself feeling dysregulated. The emotional release breathwork sessions will help you release what your body has been holding on to so you actually have some space for the good to come in. Through parts work and compassionate integration, you can get your protectors to calm the hell down so they are not running the show 24/7. Plus, this is 75 minutes each week that you're actually dedicating purely to your own healing journey. And just a reminder, if for some reason you can't make it to a session live, replays will be made available within 24 hours. So we are kicking off next week, January 13th, and we have 4 spots left. So if you are ready to make 2026 the year you actually put your nervous system first, grab your damn spot now. Head to adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. So that is adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. Breathe has an E at the end. Again, consider this your aggressive yet loving nudge. I thought the problem was in my head, but apparently it's also in my shoulders, my gut, my jaw, and my nervous system. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy and happy New Year's, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic and dysfunctional family. I'm a recovering alcoholic myself, and this is the podcast where we talk about what the hell to do when you realize that your childhood screwed you up more than you initially thought. We curse here. You've been warned. I'm an acquired taste. You've been warned. Welcome aboard this hot mess of a healing ship. So today, folks, we are diving deep with IFS practitioner Ruth Culver. So I heard Ruth back in, it was like March or April, on Tammy Schollenberger's podcast, The One Inside. And the moment I heard that episode, I was like, I have to have her on. So in that episode, she discusses this really fascinating model, or it's like a PDF that she created. It's called the Survive and Thrive Spiral. And this combines internal family systems and polyvagal theory. So basically blending the nervous system perspective with IFS. And so I put a link to this sheet in the show notes. If you have a chance, I recommend pulling it up eventually, period. But if you have a chance now, I recommend pulling it up so you can see it now and have it for when you listen to the interview. I think it'd be helpful. But yeah, so you'll find a link to that in the show notes. So a few weeks ago, a month ago, I did an episode on all the different ways that the body keeps the score. And I mentioned that we would be diving more into somatic healing. Well, internal family systems and polyvagal theory are two modalities of somatic healing that we can use. And lately, I have really been diving into polyvagal theory. I've been reading some of Deb Dana's books, and she has this concept. And it was Andy Carlson brought it up in my episode with him, however, a few weeks ago, was this concept of that story follows state. And so basically what this means is that the state of our nervous system comes first. So before the story we tell ourselves, the way that our body is feeling, the state that our nervous system is in, is what is influencing the narrative that we end up hearing in our head. So recognizing that, you know, what we think in our head, what we think and feel, is being influenced by the physiological state that we are in. And this can be applied to, you know, the story that we tell ourselves about any particular situation. So we will have 3 different versions of the same story depending upon which nervous state we are in. Are we in a safe and calm space? Are we feeling anxious or on edge? Are we in shutdown? So each state can shape a totally different narrative in our mind. So let's say you get a text from a friend that just says, let's say like, hey, can you talk later? If your nervous system is in a calm, regulated state, you might just think to yourself like, oh, they want to talk to me. Like, or yeah, I'd love to chat with them. Let's say you're feeling anxious or you're in a fight flight state. You might think like, what did I do? You know, something's wrong. And then if you're in a shutdown or collapse state, you might just think, you know, I can't handle this. Like, I'm just going to avoid this. I don't even want to talk to them. So in that one simple text can lead to three completely different stories, just depending upon whatever state your nervous system is in. But for me, I've been thinking about this a little bit from a different angle. I haven't been thinking about it from the perspective of like, how do I handle something that comes up? It's been more so about what do I do when I notice that I'm dysregulated, like when I'm off? And for me, the biggest ways that that shows up is it's a lot of overthinking or overwhelm. And a lot of the times, you know, like the story in my head is I can't do this. There's like almost like a learned helplessness part that will come in. But a lot of the times it's like, I can't do this is kind of like the main, I guess, the main story that is coming through. And so I've been just thinking about this because I do IFS therapy. Like that's the therapy modality that I do. Love my therapist. But so I've been thinking about this from the perspective of like, okay, I noticed that a part is activated, but then thinking about this whole story follows state. So like the story being like the part, and how would I tackle that moment differently, like from those two perspectives? So from the polyvagal theory perspective, the first thing that we do is we'd focus on regulating the nervous system. So, you know, noticing what state we're feeling, whether it's fight, flight or shutdown. For me, it's like typically fight, flight. And then using various grounding or co-regulation tools. For me, like the biggest thing is breath work to try to shift ourselves back into a more regulated place. So it's really about first working directly with the body. But then if we're, you know, going about this from an IFS perspective, we'd first shift to notice which part of us is activated, getting curious about which part of us is feeling overwhelmed or anxious or whatever it is. For me, you know, I've already identified these parts, so I typically know which part is showing up. And then it's about bringing compassion to that part or asking it like, you know, what do you need from me? Or just asking it, can you give me a little bit of space? So it's more about that internal dialogue and working with those parts. And so what I've been thinking about is what if instead of just going straight to the part, what if I first tried to get a little bit more regulated first? Like sometimes that's not always possible though, right? Like sometimes that's not possible, but what if I can get my nervous system a little bit more settled before I approach that part? It's kind of like those three different ways that we might perceive a text message. Might my part receive me differently if I come to it from a more calmer or more grounded place? So that is just what's been going on in Andrea's head lately, what I've been thinking about. And so I was just really excited to be able to dive into this with Ruth as well. And just to give you a little bit more of a heads up on what you'll see, hopefully maybe you've had an opportunity to pull up that the sheet, but basically what she has in there is she's laid out the different types of protectors or defense mechanisms that might show up in each of the nervous system states that we're in. So, you know, when we're in a fight or flight or hyper aroused sympathetic state, she's identified the kind of protectors that tend to come up. And then when we're in a more collapsed or dorsal vagal hypoarousal state, she maps out the different set of protectors that might show up there. So I think it's just a really, really, really helpful tool that helps us to map our internal family with our nervous system. So on that note, let's get the damn show on the road. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show, my online support community where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups, or you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. This is a support system at your fingertips, in your back pockets, with a bunch of really cool people. This is unlike anywhere else. This is a recovery community with a personality, with a sense of humor, where we also have a ton of small groups that are based off different interests or struggles, like shit show parenting. We have a childhood sexual abuse survivors group. They have a meeting every Wednesday. We have neurodivergent issues, healing from narcissists, divorce and separation, shit show dudes who are, let's get a damn meeting together, shit show dudes, and much, much more. Food struggles, addiction stuff. There's a bunch of stuff in there. So you, yes, you, yes, you, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever. How about we just do the damn thing already? Today's the day. Let's do it. Let's just do it. See the link in the show notes, or you can go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow. Next, give me a little follow on Insta and TikTok at adultchildpod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, 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 give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. It was my pleasure to introduce Ruth Culver. So I heard you talk about this survive and thrive spiral on Tammy's podcast. And I had just, in the few months leading up to that, had realized that I had been stuck in functional freeze for 18 months and had no damn clue. So when I heard you, it blew my mind. So I want to get there, but first I want to talk about you. Well, welcome, first of all.
Thank you.
So happy to have you here. Because I think what you're doing is so important, and I wish there was like more of a talk about combining IFS with a nervous system. But let's start with you, okay? So here's my first question. When did you realize that your childhood screwed you up more than you thought?
Whew. Do you know, I think that's a gradual realizing just how much. I guess I had inklings through my 20s, learned a bit more in my 30s. 40s, I'm like, whoa, this is a thing. And 50s, I'm like, yeah, let's work with this. Yeah.
Were there any like real pivotal moments?
Well, I got sick. I got so unwell. And the doctors, even the functional medics, none of them could really help me. And so finally, I started really looking at the other stuff, the transgenerational, the emotional. And then I guess the nervous system, and just starting to understand how it all interacted. It really has been very cumulative, but there were certain books that were pivotal. I think reading, I guess, Pete Walker's book. Also, I suppose when I first looked at hypnotherapy, because the doctors couldn't help me and started integrating the mind and body, then that's when I got really fascinated and thought, I've got to understand this, and because it's so big. You know, there's so much to understand here about the way the mind and body interact. And then from that, you learn more and more about trauma and how it relates to you and everybody else on the planet. And wow, it's amazing.
Was it hard for you to accept that what you had endured was trauma?
Yeah, and I think that's ongoing too, especially with complex trauma, mm-hmm. where it's not one single thing and where you come from a nice middle-class household that looks mm-hmm. really functional on the outside and you've had all the advantages and all those parts who say, you didn't have it that bad. You mm-hmm. really didn't have it that bad. And even the ACE scores, you know, they're quite dramatic things. Mm-hmm. But I remember doing it was one pivotal moment, actually. I was running an IFS constellation workshop and two people did a piece of work, one after the other. One, she had been born into a very loving family with a mother who really knew how to mother and who adored her, but who died when she was age 5. And she'd had 5 years of secure attachment. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it was awful. I mean, really horrific trauma you wouldn't wish on anybody. Sent to another country, father didn't want her, different language, separated from her brother. You know, all started going very wrong. But she had this foundational base. And as I worked with her in the constellation, I saw the difference between her and the person who came next, who'd had an upbringing very much like mine. And yet there was just no base. There was no sense of safety in her nervous system.
That's so interesting. So how were you able to see like those first 5 years of secure attachment playing out in the work that you did together? Like it was just a more natural process for her to be able to find like a state of like regulation or?
Yeah, that's exactly it. That it's there. It's in the body. You can see that it, when you're working with the parts and you're separating them out, the natural compassion, the natural understanding of what attachment is, how to be with those other parts of you who feel extreme or desperate or lonely or hopeless, that there's an ability to be with them, because there's in the blueprint of the body, there's a sense of safety, a sense of trust, a sense of being good enough, a sense of being, I am lovable.
Mm-hmm.
And when that's not there at all, because nobody's had anybody there, it really shows.
Yeah, well, what was interesting for me was I was under the impression that I was somebody with high self-esteem and high self-worth who, as soon as I would get into a relationship, that would like instantly just evaporate and go down the drain. And so it was so hard for me to understand as soon as that abandonment wound was triggered in just the tiniest way, why I was acting, thinking, feeling from a place of someone who seemed to think very little of herself.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. The being able to come back to our own ground and those subtleties of boundaries, of being able to express without fawning and not fear that that means you're going to lose somebody, or if you do lose them as a result of being really clear about your boundaries or your needs, that you're just not meant to be with them and something else will come along. That sense of hope.
Nope, right? Yeah. No, I'm going to die. This is the last person on earth that will ever be interested in me, that I will ever be interested in. So we better make this shit work. So true. You had a completely different career life. When did your healing journey start? Was it kicked off? Was the catalyst the health problems? Or had you already been like dipping your toe into a therapy or mental health pond before the health stuff started to show up for you?
Good question. Health was always an issue. And, you know, I'm really curious about how much of that actually goes hand in hand with the constant, of course, if you're in a constant fight flight state, your body's under stress, there's inflammation, you're gonna have health problems. And I had them. But it was only when it became acute that I really and really couldn't work anymore. You know, I burned out, that I began to see just how much I was driving myself, how much I was living in fight flight. But it takes years to unwind this and undo this. I'm still, you know, 20 years later, after really 20 years after diving in deep, I'm still unwinding it. I'm still undoing the damage and relearning. So my early experiences with therapy were not nice, unfortunately.
Meaning not effective?
Yeah, not effective. You know, CBT, which didn't anywhere near address how I was feeling. I went into group therapy after a friend killed himself and got bullied, and the facilitator, the therapist there was no protection. So that was a replication. You know, my experiences were not good, or I'd open up all my feelings and not be given any way of being with them. So, you know, that kind of therapy, which is a bit blank slate, a blank face, and you're just left with it. Mm-hmm. So the stuff would just come up and then I'd be left with it. So that's why when I finally found IFS, it's like, oh, wow, there's a protocol for help. And there's also this sense that, okay, I, as the therapist, I'm not here to become your primary attachment figure. That's not what we're doing, but I will be here for you until you learn to, that you can do it for yourself. I'm going to be enabling you to do this more and more for yourself. So it's a magical sweet spot between the, you know, the hyper being cared for and taken care of and the not being taken care of. I'm going to hold you just in the way that a baby or a toddler needs holding and needs helping to manage their emotions and experience things and learn to self-regulate. But no, you have to co-regulate first before you can learn to self-regulate. And I think IFS allows us to learn that.
Did you end up going back to school in adulthood to become a therapist?
We did slightly differently here in the UK. Okay. We don't have the university, the masters, et cetera, of therapy, not generally. We tend to train along the side of whatever we're doing and various courses. So I was in event management for 25 years. That was my job. And I it was a perfect place to hyperachieve, hyperfocus, burnout because I was
perfectionism,
working, and especially because I was working in the arts and charity sectors where there's not enough money, and you're driven by I've got to help, you know, no one else is going to do it. So yeah, I burned out, and then as I mentioned, hypnotherapy really helped me more than anything else. And I guess because the form of hypnotherapy that I learned was both medical, so there was some clinical and medical stuff in it, which had great neuroscience behind it and worked with doctors and dentists around using it as an anesthesia, and there was lots of lovely science that it helped me trust. And then there was also this form of therapy called transforming therapy, which is very much inner child work. It looks very like IFS, but without all the brilliance of the protocol. It doesn't have the same level of healing steps. It doesn't have parts, but you do go back to a younger self, you validate, you witness what happened to them, and you bring in some of those adult resources to that child. So it looks a little bit like IFS. So I had these two forms of hypnotherapy in my training, which really was the first thing that really helped me. And then I found IFS after that. So
and was that like with a practitioner that was like guiding you through the process?
Yeah, my teacher was a lecturer at one of the medical schools in a psychology lecturer in medical psychology at one of the hospital medical schools in London. So he was, you know, he was quite something. And actually you can find him there are videos of him on YouTube having surgery without anesthetic.
Oh my gosh.
Because there are some people who can't have anesthetic. And so he was the one that they would go to, you know, for medical reasons or whatever. The doctors would go to him and say, we need to operate on this person. They can't have anesthesia. And he would anesthetize them using hypnosis. And then when he had to have his own surgery, he said, well, why would I put these drugs in my body, which is the thing that's hard to get to recover from? It's not the actual surgery, it's the drugs. So he, you know, they had legally, he had to have the anesthetist on standby, but the nurses knew him and the surgeon knew him, and you can actually find it.
Does it have a particular name for the type of hypnotherapy?
Medical anesthesia, medical hypnoanesthesia. Yeah.
That is nuts. So what is it? Wow. What does it sound like?
Well, it's not that bizarre. If you think about it, you probably know people who have had done self-hypnosis for birth. It's the same thing. They are learning to take themselves into a deep stage of relaxation and trance, whereby their body relaxes and trusts and can go with the flow and doesn't get anxious and tighten up against the pain.
I would think that for stuff like that, would you agree that the participant has to have a level of belief that it can work in order for it to be effective? Is it only really effective unless the person is willing to buy into it?
That's exactly why it works. Because if we're talking in parts language, if there's a part who is saying, this isn't going to work, they're taking the energy. And they get in the way of it working, just as they would get in the way of your access to self energy if it is calm and compassionate. And if we can be with the parts through whatever method, whether that's be by accepting the trance induction, you can't put somebody in a trance if they don't want to be in one. It's just not possible. So, well, that's not true. If they're extremely vulnerable, it is possible, but that would be unethical. So you wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. But it takes a level of buy-in for it to work, exactly as it does really with any form of therapy. If somebody's going to sit there in a part that's going, this isn't going to work, nothing.
That's the part that shows up every time, right? For me.
Yeah. And that's the first one we work with. So there are some forms of surgery which would be too, where it would be very, very hard. But his was
like open heart surgery.
Yeah. You would need to be anesthetized for that. But his was a hernia operation. It was very small. It was keyhole surgery. It wasn't major. But I have my own experience. Do you want to hear my own
experience?
Please. Okay.
We share it all here.
So I had surgery a few years back. And I said to my surgeon, what kind of blood flow do you want? And she was like, what? And I don't know how, but she somehow just managed to give me exactly the right answer. Instead of saying what she didn't want, which would, if she'd done that, my mind would have focused on the thing she didn't want. Yeah. She just said, normal, healthy blood flow is all we need. So she just gave me this positive, what we've called a positive suggestion. So I incorporated that into my hypno preparation, which was telling my body what was going to happen. And I used this recording every day for a month before my surgery.
Where were you being operated on, if you don't mind me asking?
I had breast cancer. Luckily, it was early. So it was a very small, you know, it was a small early tumor that needed.
Was it laparoscopic or were they cutting you open?
No, the scar is like an inch long.
Okay.
Yeah. But so I told myself there'd be normal, healthy blood flow. And I told my body what to expect and told my body how long the surgery was going to be, visualized all the trust in my surge. You know, there was just so much positivity that therefore I was not tense and anxious when I went into it. So this was the first time. I'd had a few surgeries before earlier in my life. And every time I'd come around from the surgery, I'd been anxious, crying, you know, there was kind of confusion. It was really distressing and really unpleasant. This one, when I'd known to prepare with hypnosis, was utterly different. I came round, I felt okay. I didn't need to take any painkillers after my surgery, literally none, apart from the nausea from the drugs.
And you were not put under?
No, I was put under.
Okay.
No, absolutely. But I didn't need painkillers afterwards because my body was not stressed.
Mm-hmm.
And my surgeon said, I do not know what you did, but I was operating for 2.5 hours. And normally the flaps, the edges of the skin would have started to dry out. And it would have been, you know, it creates a bad scar because, you know, you're trying to sew it back together, but it's dried out. She said, yours was just like it had been freshly cut. It was like I'd literally just cut it and then I was sewing it up. And so the scar is beautiful and discreet. And she said, I don't know what you did. And I just told my body that it was going to be normal, healthy blood flow. So it didn't dry out. So
how did you know to even ask that?
Because I was already using this hypnosis, I've got a very inquiring mind. So I Googled hypnosis for surgery. I found this amazing. I mean, there's all sorts of things out there, but I found one that my body liked. You know, I listened to various recordings. I found one that my body liked, and that's what I listened to. I have since sent it on to a number of people, including doctors, for them to prepare to their own surgery. They love it. But the basis on which, okay, so you asked that question, I'll rewind. How did I know to prepare? Because when I did my clinical...
Well, I mean, specifically asking the blood flow question.
Yeah, that was spontaneous. Mm. But my clinical training had included learning about hospitals in some other countries where they would give a choice of pre-med. Do you want it hypnotic pre-med, i.e. that to take you into a trance, or do you want chemical pre-med, so a drug to relax you? So I knew that this had been studied, and there are outcomes shown that the hypnotic pre-med is just as good, if not better. And I also knew about the studies that had been done because there were some of the people I studied with were anesthetists. And the reason they were there was they were pediatric anesthetists. And so they were working with children for whom the level of, because they've got tiny bodies, the level of room for error was the amount of anesthetic they're giving them is really small. Mm. So they want to give them a minimum amount of anesthetic. So therefore relaxing them fully or partially with hypnosis, just general relaxation. We know it hurts more if you tense against it. It hurts less if you relax. We know that. So it's taking that further. So I was aware that it works, that this hypnosis works. So when I went into my, this is the weird thing that happened around that same surgery. When I went into the meeting with the anesthetist that morning, I said, I'm going to be pre-medding myself with hypnosis. And she had a cold. She was grumpy. She was really not on my wavelength. And she said, we don't pre-med in this hospital. She was kind of very brusque with me. Yeah. So I just did what I do. And unfortunately, the information I was trying to give her, which is I am going to need less anesthetic because I'm so relaxed, because I know this from the clinical trials, I didn't give her that information. Therefore, I had too much anesthetic. And I know this because I came round finally and my surgeon was standing there and she said, thank goodness you finally arrived. Everyone's gone home. Like literally, I've had to wait for you to come around from your anesthetic. And we were already into the night stuff. I should have come around 2 hours before. And they unfortunately had given me lots of painkillers because they thought that when they were kind of going, wake up, you know, and kind of prodding me. And I was going,
like, you were in too much pain and that's why you weren't waking up. Yeah.
But I wasn't, I just had too much anesthetic. So I was very ill from the anesthetic. So it wasn't until my body literally threw off literally had to throw up to get rid of the anesthetic that I started feeling better. So I know this works. So then the next time I encountered a friend who was going for surgery, I gave her the recording and I gave her the printout of the report and she showed it to her anesthetist, and her anesthetist said, yes, you did indeed need less anesthetic because you were so relaxed. And I've proved this over and over with friends that this stuff works. So then when I had surgery again last year, I did exactly the same. And lo and behold, I needed very little anesthetic. No nausea, no painkillers, no nothing. It works.
Wow. I'd be really curious to look into just the history of that, right? I would think that this has probably been used for thousands of years.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where it comes from. It comes from the first guy to bring hypnosis to Europe was completely denigrated by the British Medical Association, or what are they called now? Because he brought it from his work in India, and he discovered, you know, people lying on beds of nails and not feeling the pain and all that kind of stuff. So he was bringing it in, and they just said, no, you don't bring any of your nonsense in here. So good for me, good psychotherapy is actually built on the foundations of hypnotherapy, you know, of relaxing, of coming into in connection with the subconscious, the body that holds all this information. And I really believe that IFS, internal family systems, is more like a hypnotherapy than a psychotherapy, because we're working with that process. We're going into a kind of just gentle trance process of asking the thinking mind to just make a little space for us to come in connection with the other things that are here, the information that comes direct from the body, and then working with that within a safe container.
Well, I would think that your foundation with hypnotherapy probably made the IFS process a lot more natural for you.
Completely. I was trained with three other hypnotherapists on my level one, and we all found it so easy in comparison to others. And we're used to working with scripts and you know, structures and protocols, very, very different from many forms of psychotherapy.
How did you stumble upon it?
It was my beautiful, precious supervisor, mentor. She brought so many things to me. You know, she taught me so much. And she was the one who first introduced me to polyvagal theory and to IFS.
Yeah. So why not tell the backstory of why you decided to create this chart, this worksheet. And if people want to pull it up, I'll put it in the show notes. But at some point, people probably will find it helpful to be looking at it as we discuss it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so it's called the Survive Thrive Spiral. And just to say, if you're looking at a version that doesn't have an arrow across the middle with the word freeze in it, you're looking at an old version. Because unfortunately, I mean, it's amazing it went viral, but somebody pulled it out before I was ready, before I completed it and really understood it fully, before I'd spoken to Stephen Porges about it and refined it and changed it. So someone pulled it out and kind of put it on the internet before it was ready. So it needs the arrow going across to be the latest version. So I was working with groups, with small groups, doing constellations. And it was at a time that I hadn't even fully integrated internal family systems into the way I was doing constellations. I was working with trauma and internal parts around trauma, but it wasn't complete, wasn't the IFS protocol. So I was learning IFS and polyvagal at the same time. I was witnessing in the groups, people being the participants being taken over by parts, you know, people pleasing or panicking or numbing out or, you know, whatever was going on, I would see it and we would welcome in and work with it. I didn't know at that point how to do it fully. So I was still learning. And I just started drawing, first of all, the window of tolerance, you know, the Dan Siegel model. Mm-hmm. I drew that to try and explain to people a little bit of psychoeducation. Look, this is going to happen. You'll notice yourself dissociating. You'll notice yourself trying to, you know, being revved up and trying to help yourself or manage. And as I explained it, I began to see that there were multiple things happening at once. So multiple parts, obviously. You might have both. You might have a freezing going on, a fawning, a fleeing, a fighting, all kind of cycling between these different parts all at once. So I began to see it was really quite complex, not simple, but also primarily that the window of tolerance model, which has hyper arousal at the top and hypo arousal at the bottom. So that's the sympathetic nervous system, all the adrenalized process at the top. And then the...
Like fight, flight.
Yeah. And then the opposite of that, the collapse, the hypo at the bottom. But in the middle was this thing called the window of tolerance. The way my brain works, the systems, no, you don't go through the window of tolerance. You don't go through a regulated state to get from one from the other. This just doesn't work that way. So I started turning it on its head and trying to map it out as it actually works, which is from a regulated state, which is at the bottom, which is grounded for me, right at the bottom. then the first thing that happens is the adrenaline comes in. And I'm talking about biological response here. The adrenaline kicks in. Heck, I need to help myself here. And then if we can't do that, then we will go to a hypoarousal state, which is more of a submitting and then fully collapsing, you know, just kind of dissociation, leaving. If you're an animal, or even a human, you faint, you collapse, you play dead. And this is a progression of survival processes. And then gradually understood more and more that the free state is slightly different, because what people call freeze, you're actually still going about your business. But the true freeze, it's like ice. It's frozen. Mm-hmm. It's the deer in the headlights. You know, if there's a deer standing in front of a truck that's coming towards it with, you know, it's going to run it over, but the deer can't move. Its heart is pumping madly. It might even explode with the terror, but it can't move. That's a true freeze. It's solid, like ice. And I spoke to Stephen Porges about this, who's the creator of polyvagal theory, yep. And he you know, really understood that that's what freeze is. Freeze is not the same as collapse. That's floppy. And so this submit state, whether you're fawning or, you know, kind of half giving up, this mixed state, there's enough sympathetic nervous system energy to be still moving, still doing, but there's also enough shutdown for you to be numb and getting towards the full collapse. That's not freeze.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of like how common is like actual pure freeze?
Yeah.
And would we stay in that for very long?
Yeah, I don't think we do generally. It's possible that catatonia could be that. I'm not really sure. I'd need to look into that a bit more. But it tends to be a slightly more transitory state because the other parts will take over. There may be a part of us going, I don't know what to do. But then a part will come in and either attack or take us away or start people-pleasing in order to manage. The survival instincts will kick in. Doesn't mean to say there isn't a freeze there. And I believe that freeze is where we fragment. That's where the split happens. So the feelings that can't be processed, whatever they are, terror or grief or rage, can't be processed. It has to be put away. Literally, we're fragmenting. And this is what I would call you'll see it on the spiral graphic. It's circular. It's in the middle. It's a reservoir of unprocessed feeling. What we call exiles in IFS. It's literally exiled. I cannot process this stuff. I need to put it somewhere.
Mm. And so then within the fight flight level, and then we go up into the collapse submit level, we have protectors and exiles in both categories.
Yeah. So on the graphic, what you'll see is that the exiles, the circle, this reservoir of exiles is actually straddles
between the two,
fight flight and the submit collapse. So it's in between the two. So actually you can see it visually surrounded by the protectors of all types. They're all the way around it, keeping those feelings away, keeping them safe. Don't go near this. It's too dangerous. We don't want to feel this way again. They keep it away. They keep it safe.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think the importance and the benefit is in bringing in the nervous system states like to this conversation?
Yeah, I think it's to do with understanding when it's not our fault. This is a natural survival process. We are supposed to do this. We are supposed to go into these emergency states when there are emergencies. The only problem is that if we don't have that ground to come back to, if we don't have go right back to the beginning of our conversation. If the knowledge of what resilience, of what safety and connection, co-regulation, self-regulation should feel like, if we don't know how to get back there, we haven't built that skill, then we get stuck in a survival state. So by knowing that, yeah, it's okay that you shouted back or you ran away, you hid, because that's what your body is supposed to do. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not broken. It's just that because maybe you didn't have this other stuff, which you can learn, that you got stuck there because you didn't know there was an alternative and you hadn't practiced it. And we learn by practicing. I speak English because my parents spoke English. I had to practice to learn it. And we can do exactly the same with our nervous system. It takes a bit of work, but we can absolutely do it.
It takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't really get the body keeps the score for a long time. I got it, but I didn't get it. You know, like I read the book, but I, you know, it was almost like I was only viewing it from the perspective of autoimmune issues or horrible chronic pain and stuff like that. And I was completely oblivious to the fact that I lived in a constant low-grade state of hypervigilance, you know, because it's all we know. I think there's so many people that are either living in that low-grade hypervigilance or that like low-grade collapse and just have no idea. And so it was like a series of events. Some out of my, it's clear to me, like it all happened exactly like the way that it was supposed to, but of thinking that I was like so much more further healed than I was. And then realizing, oh wow, like the somatic work is not just important. It's absolutely vital, you know? And then when you're talking about with like how long it takes to unravel, it's like, I feel like it finally caught up to me on a body level. Like I'm 36 now. And just like the years of living in that, like with my shoulders up at my ear, and just finally it's all caught up. And it's just, I continue over the past year and a half, like my mind is blown at like how I was able to really be completely dissociated from this stored like survival energy that's just been in my body and wreaking havoc the whole time.
I totally get what you're saying. And I don't think you're unusual in that. I think this is how it is. And it's really easy to think that there should be a moment where we get it, or that we should have got it earlier. I mean, I'm still in that unraveling. I'm 60 this as of last week. And I'm still in that same process that you are describing. It's just that the insights get more regular. The extremes are less extreme. I could go back and read the same text over and over and each time get more and more out of it, more understanding. So I think it's really important that we don't beat ourselves up for not getting it.
Oh, because absolutely.
We literally can't. It's not possible. It is a gradual process.
It unfolds the way it has to unfold. Yeah. Right. And I think for a lot of us, at least for me, it's a great transformation comes from excruciating pain. But I am curious, like, because I have really been diving into polyvagal a lot more recently. And I'm curious what your thoughts are regarding like Deb Dana's idea of story follows state. And if you see there being any sort of conflict with that and IFS. Right? There's some in the same of we do need to access like some self, but we kind of are going directly to the part. Whereas with her, it's like we can't even begin to address the story or even go to the thoughts, the stories or whatever it is that's there until we get to a place of more safety. And it's also the thought, the thing of what I'm thinking, the narrative that I'm hearing is not necessarily true. It's like my brain trying to make sense of whatever it is that I'm experiencing in my body. Whereas in a way to me, that almost feels like it's not validating maybe the parts in a way, but I'm just curious like what your idea or what your thoughts are on all of that.
A lot. And I try and align. Yeah. You know,
go remember, wherever you want.
Remember each one that came up as you're talking.
Lots yeah. Sorry. Support.
It's great. It's great. You fired my brain off. I think that we need enough connection to safety, just enough. You know, in IFS, we would say a critical mass of self-energy. And in one-to-one therapy, this is why it's quite useful, especially when we're in a, you know, really difficult state where things are still early in our healing. Having somebody else who can provide that for us as an anchor, just like the baby needs the parent to be self-regulated for them to learn to regulate themselves. It needs to be enough provided there. And we will gradually learn to top that up and increase it, but it'll always come and go, always. So there needs to be enough for us to get there. The story follows state thing, the way I interpret that, a lot of that is that the body is faster than the mind. Mm-hmm. You know, we know that, but the messages come faster. So therefore, my interpretation or my memory or whatever comes up will be slower than the automatic reaction, the instinctive reaction, which is coming straight from the body. So if I can ask the parts to just hang on a minute, especially the very logical ones, the slower ones, those connected with the prefrontal cortex, which are the slowest of all, the logical thought. If we can ask the analysis and the storytelling and the rationalization just to wait and to listen to the source. You know, when you're at university, say, go to the primary source. Don't quote secondaries. Go to the primary source. So if we can make space to really be with the first thing that comes.
The sensation.
Yeah. Then more will emerge. And that's actually one reason why I work the way I work with the drawing into self. Do you want me to say a little bit about that way? So I have found that externalization is super useful. So working with your parts on the outside is super useful. For people with very overwhelmed systems who need a bit of titration, bit of slowing down, for whom it's too much to go inside, for whom it's difficult to go inside, people with maybe lots of very strong cognitive parts, people with neurocomplexity, a lot of people like working on the outside because it really helps them get a sense of things. Now, there's a real difference between mapping something cognitively, like this is here and this is here and this is what the map looks like. Now, I'm talking about something different, which is listening to the body, having a feeling in the body. So imagine right now, if you were to remember a time when you felt happy, you know, just like one moment, like when your cat's purring in your lap or something like that, and you can feel it in your body. And then as you feel it in your body, just to imagine, to savor it, and then just notice the first thing that comes up. If I said, and I'm going to ask you this question now, if this feeling that you're feeling right now, of what it feels like when your cat's purring in your lap, if that had a color, what color would it be? And what's the first thing that comes up for you, Andrea?
Blue.
Right. So the blue, it came without you even thinking, yeah? And then probably your mind wanted to change it or rationalize it or whatever.
But, oh, 100%. And I'm like not like visual or artsy. So of course, as you're saying it and me knowing that you're going to ask it, like I'm thinking, am I going to come up with anything?
But if and you can learn to do this, you know, you can learn to get the parts to wait, but just to listen to the very first impulse and go, okay, so just pick up that blue and then feel it again in your body. And as you're feeling it, just without trying. Mm. Imagine that feeling of just, well, don't even have to imagine anything.
That's so easy. Feeling. Just without trying, you know, like, yeah, I can just do that so easily.
Yeah. And this is the learning to learn to do this. This is the process of basically getting parts to step back of, okay, well, I'm going to ask you an easier one. If you were really angry and you grabbed a red, like what would that look like? If you did that now with your body, what would that red shape look
all
like?
Over, yeah, right? All over the place.
See how easy it is. Mm-hmm. There you go. So now we've got a way in. It's easy to do with anger. It'll be all over the place, really big and scribbly. That is available for everything else too. Mm. We come from a place of where do we start with the trust? So by representing these feelings on paper, it does several things. It helps to come into connection with it, to witness it, get a little bit of relief from it taking us over inside because, whoa, that huge scribble on the paper of all that rage, I can see it and witness it and go, well, yeah, it's really big. And start to listen and validate. And that part of us that feels really angry gets to feel seen and allowed and welcomed. And I don't have to hold it in my body and try to deal with the feeling, which can be embarrassing or too much or too stressful, or there it is on the paper. So by externalizing in this way, by listening to the body, it takes down the extremity of it in some way without having to push it away. So it's a completely different way. Instead of saying, can you ask that part to step back, which is what we're taught in IFS, welcome that one onto the page. And what else comes in when you put that big red scribble on? Oh, up comes some shame. I shouldn't be angry. Anger is bad. Great. Stay with that now. Welcome that one in. So we're starting to welcome the parts onto the page just as they are. And we make little notes to it next to them, validating them, and we come into relationship. And we end up with this somatically connected map that's very temporary. It's not a fixed in stone map. This is a snapshot of how it is right now. And these parts can start to talk to us and we can listen because they're no longer hammering away on the inside or being asked to make space. They're all welcome. We get to see how they relate to each other. How, you know, some part like the black one over there hates the yellow one. And it all sounds a bit far-fetched maybe until you experience it. And then, you know, thousands of people now have experienced it and gone, wow, this is the easiest way to do IFS.
Well, I was just about to ask you that. Like, if you found that that's something that is helpful for people who maybe don't come as naturally to the process.
Yeah, it helps a lot of people. A lot of my clients are neurodivergent or complex trauma. And I now train people in this. I mean, I was just running groups during lockdown. It was a great way to work with groups because I really believe that working one-to-one, it's very expensive. There's only so many therapists and we need to learn to heal in connection.
Because, it's relational trauma.
Exactly. So the co-witnessing, the level of being able to talk about your parts in a safe, held environment is wonderful. So I was doing this during lockdown. And then more and more therapists started turning up and saying, can you teach me to do this? So I've been teaching it now. And I'm writing a manual, a book, which is a manual to go with the training. But a lot of
specifically for the drawing.
Specifically for this. And I call it drawing into self. Mm-hmm. And by drawing, it's a play on words. You know, we're not making art. This is about process, not product. But drawing, of course, drawing, it means coming, you know, drawing means coming closer, drawing into self. And I also call it spontaneous scribbling, because if you can scribble, you can do this. It is just a load of scribbles. It is not about a pretty picture. And if there are parts trying to make a pretty picture, we work with those first. The perfectionists or the judges. Yeah, they're the first ones. Yeah, I run retreats. I run lots of different groups working this way. And I love, I just did a group experiential. There were 230 people there where we all worked with the qualities of self and welcomed the parts in around the outside. It's my biggest group so far. And I'm
Was it in person?
It was online. Uh-huh. It was online. We were raising money for charity. We raised £5,000 for Médecins Sans Frontières, which was wonderful. And lots of people got their first experience of working with parts in this way. And I'm delighted because people keep saying we're looking for a way of doing IFS with bigger groups. And I think this might be a way, a really good way of doing it. So I want to do more.
I love it. Do you think that this is something that, I mean, to me, it seems like this is something too, that just could be effective for somebody if they're alone and they're feeling dysregulated and a way to connect with parts just on your own.
That's the other thing. I mean,
in a way that's not super overwhelming.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You can put them on paper. I do it for myself. We know when I'm triggered, when I'm activated, it takes me a while to remember sometimes, but when I remember and when I do it and I put it on paper, I always brings both relief and also insights. I can actually work with my parts, which going inside and meditating is hard, especially on your own. But here you can do it on the outside. You can maybe co-witness as one person. I have a couple of buddies who I send the drawing to, and I'll, you know, when I've just done one and I'll speak for my parts to them, they'll do the same back. So some of these groups that I've worked with, they're still years later working with each other without a therapist. Mm. They're co-witnessing, it's peer-led. And if you've done a one-to-one process, you then got it on paper, you don't have to remember it because you've made some notes, you've got a way to keep working with those parts in between. You've got a note of saying what they want, you know, how they want you to stay in connection. The very fact that you have your drawing means you can stay in connection and you can do it yourself. So I've taught this to a group of people in a project, an IFS-led project in El Salvador, where there's no money for one-to-one therapy. These mm-hmm. women are running community groups for traumatized women in their village. And they're using this method to connect with their own parts, to express their own parts so that they don't feel too overwhelmed and so that the person they're talking to doesn't feel too overwhelmed because the page is the container.
And it really is a beautiful way of combining the co-regulation aspect of polyvagal theory with IFS.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
Have you ever run into circumstances with clients of yours who, where there really does need to be them learning more grounding tools and maybe just having more of a focus on finding some sense in the body, some safety in the body, and maybe just viewing things from, it just blows my mind, like how much of this all really just stems from, I just don't feel safe in my body, you know, and just instead of just like all of the thoughts that just come in our mind. And just, I'm just curious if you found like when somebody is able to maybe have some bit of a foundation in grounding and regulation tools and kind of in polyvagal, that therefore then the IFS process is a little bit more seamless.
Yeah, I think that that's very true. If a client is only going to one-to-one therapy and they're not able to do anything for themselves in between, we're not really doing them a favor. Mm. I think that the psychoeducation, the understanding the nervous system, the de-shaming that comes with that, this is a natural process. And you didn't learn it and you can learn it. And so simply extending your out-breath is biologically known to calm the system. And if that doesn't, if the breath doesn't feel safe for you now, there will be other ways. You know, I love this kind of bilateral stimulation where you just squeeze, so you cross your arms in front of you and you squeeze or gently stroke from one shoulder down, you know, from shoulders down, or alternate tapping either side. So that these are not fixes to get rid of parts. They're ways to go to validate. Oh, wow. There's a lot happening right now. I just need to have enough space, enough pause, just to kind of come to a little bit of a looking around right here, right now. Am I safe? Whatever it is, finding the thing, and it might only be one thing, you know, just, I just need to go for a walk and not take my phone and go walk for 10 minutes. And that alternate feet on the pavement will calm my nervous system. And then I can be with my parts and start to validate. But yeah, sometimes we just need to deal with the body first. Absolutely.
Which is hard when you've spent your whole life to be disconnected from it, right?
Yeah, because that was all you could have. Yeah.
Were you more of a, like a shutdown collapser or hypervigilance?
Well, there's this great thing about being multiple. You know, we have multiple parts. I was doing both at once. Mm-hmm. I was utterly disconnected from my body and hypervigilant at the same time, both parts. So of course I got chronic fatigue because I was going between shutdown and hyperactivation. Yeah.
What I've heard you speak to, which I think is really interesting and important for people to hear, is how we can have several parts activated at the same time in various nervous system states. And I'm curious, like, why is that something important for us to understand? And like, where do we start? You know what I mean? Does that help us in a way to know what to tackle first, or who to, you know, which part to come to first?
Yeah. So this is another reason I like mapping multiple parts rather than just saying, okay, get everybody to stand back and just work with one. Because if I look at a situation, so I was at a family gathering recently, there was some activation, but if I map those on paper of all the parts who turned up in that, you know, there was a fawner, there was a fighter, there was a fleer, there was a justifier, there was a, you know, there was all these different parts, and I kind of cycled between them as they were all trying to find a way, a breakneck speed, trying to find a way to deal with this. And then underneath it, there was the part for whom nothing worked and nothing ever has worked. And so she's hopeless. So that's the exile, trapped. Mm-hmm. Nothing's ever going to work. So by mapping all of that afterwards, I was able to go, wow, all of this happened at once. And of course, at different times, one was taking the fall. You know, one was coming to the front and going, it's your fault. And another part going, shh, don't say anything. And they would alternate. There they all were, all the survival strategies all at once. And of course, family gatherings is where they come up because you regress, don't you? So it's taken me a while to see that. And I think before that, there was a sense of there's this one big one that, you know, for many people, it's maybe alcohol or food or depression, whatever big one will take over. You have to spend a bit of time with that. Then you start seeing the subtlety in this incredible system, complex system within us all, where loads of parts are all trying to help all at the same time. And that ability to come into, wow, you're all amazing. And if you take me over, we're going to get the same as we've always had. Let's just pause with this and just check in.
What's been interesting for me, I've noticed that, so like total phone addiction here. And I've noticed that it's harder, and maybe this is just the way it is with dissociation parts. It's harder for me to notice in the moment that I'm in a part. Like I can notice that I'm doing it, that I'm checking out on my phone. But it's interesting how the realization of this being a part is a real struggle for me to get to in the moment.
I think that's the dangerous thing about phones, you know, and I think it's why so many young people are really struggling now. This is a really new thing. And it both allows us to dissociate and get dopamine fixes all at the same time. So it's very clever. The evil genius has taken us over. And it's hard to undo that once we're addicted to it. But
it's horrible. And I don't think we're talking about it enough. I'm trying to find somebody who's like more of an expert on it. But like, Ruth, I think that like I got an ADHD diagnosis in like the, I don't know if it's 2024. 2023. And I don't think I have ADHD.
I really think it's the damage, the changes to my brain that my phone has had on me. And the level of, oh, I get emotional thinking about it now. Like the amount of time that I've wasted over the past 10 years, you know, on my phone, there is a real heaviness there. You know, and I do have compassion for myself in what you're saying, like the amount of money that has gone into trying to figure out how to get us glued to that fucking thing. Like, I understand that it's not, you know, like this is like some deliberate manipulation bullshit, you know, that has been intentionally done to us. So I do have some compassion there, but man, it's hard. I've been sober for 17 years, but I feel like I need to go to fucking phone rehab for 4 days. I need phone detox.
Mm-hmm. You and most of the people on the, on the privileged planet. Yeah. Me too.
It's awful.
It is awful. It's an absolute plague upon us. And waking up to that, which I think people are starting to do, you know, a lot of damage has been done, but people are starting to wake up to it. A friend of mine just lost her phone for 2 days and she went, oh my God, you know, I saw the light, what is possible. And then we can start to put in some boundaries and it's hard. And this is a challenge. It's like the availability of sugar. You know, our ancestors did not have it. They did not have the availability of alcohol. We have it. We have these amazing privileges and there are some massive disadvantages to them.
Oh, I'm a real junkie. I mean, I buy the things like if they're, you know, whether it's like a certain thing to block or whatever. And I'm finding every which way to jailbreak that shit. Like people are like, oh, just do this. I'm like, no, I'm like a real crackhead when it comes to my phone. Yeah.
But I think that this is where we can see that the parts are trying to fix it and they're never going to do that. Mm-hmm. It's only access to our own self-regulation, our own spaciousness. Mm-hmm. And as that starts to nurture us more and more, we'll do it less and less and it'll come and go.
Absolutely. It does ebb and flow. And there is a lot more. The shame spirals connected with it are not nearly as intense as, and that, you know, sometimes it's like you have a bad day and sometimes I know I'm like, all right, this day is just fucked, you know, and that's okay. Because once you get to a certain point, it's no creative ideas are coming in and it really does matter so much in how I start my day. And breath work has been like a life like saver for me.
Exactly. It's finding the stuff that helps and just doing more of that rather than trying to fix it with the jailbreak, you know, scenarios.
Would that be your dissociation drug of choice?
Oh, I have many. Mm-hmm. Work, mm-hmm. Phone, food, whatever, you know, there's plenty.
And what are your go-to, like in the moment, regulation tools?
Drawing. Like really, if I can get myself to the paper and the pastels, it works every time. But yeah, just taking a walk outside. I mean, genuinely, I think that is nature's absolute gift. Step outside the door, take a walk around the block. Magic.
Absolutely. Have many of your family members also embarked on a healing journey, or are you kind of the lone wolf?
Oh, yeah. My sister is a certified IFS practitioner as well.
Wow. When did that happen? Was that before, after
you? No, after me. She had kids and, you know, had a, I guess I was ahead of her in that way because she was busy with a family. But yeah, she's now certified and she's a body worker. So she uses TRE, tremoring, alongside the IFS. She's fab. She works with me on my retreats as well. And I think one of my other siblings is also doing some IFS. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
You're lucky.
Yeah.
That's rare to get two people. And I'm curious, do you guys all have different like experiences of when you reflect back on your upbringing?
Yeah, it's so interesting to discover. I mean, my sister and I talk about it a lot, how different parts would respond to the same challenge because, you know, birth order changes things and a specific experience changes things, you know, when a certain, one sibling sees another sibling having one experience, they might do something different to try and find a different way of managing it. Neurology also is different. My neurology is very different from my sister's.
Where do you fall in the birth order?
I'm number three.
Okay.
And I'm probably, you know, I have very naive, impulsive parts. So I would just walk into the lion's mouth. You know, I wasn't able to protect myself in ways that maybe other siblings did. So things evolve differently. I'm so lucky that my sister did engage with ISS, and, you know, so proud of her for the work she's doing now as well. It's I feel very blessed.
What role do you feel like you played?
I guess I identify as a scapegoat because mm-hmm. I was so innocent and easy to wind up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very emotional. Yeah.
So what do you have planned? What do you want to promote?
Oh, I'm not very good at promoting things. So I do roughly monthly, I do a thing called this Exploring the Survive Thrive Spiral, which anybody can come to, both practitioners, you know, therapists, and anybody else who has an interest in it can come. I've got a YouTube video where you can just learn a little bit more about the spiral and what it is. And then when we do the exploring workshop, we're using this intuitive mark making to work through the different strategies somatically that come up in your system when you're encountering challenges. So you're learning more about your own responses, nervous system responses, through this intuitive drawing process. So it's a really cool workshop. I love doing that. Links on my website, which is calmheart.co.uk. And then I'm running some retreats later in the year, one on using the intuitive drawing, one on blame, shame, and the inner critic. And then later in the year, there's one called Hungry for Wholeness, which is on eating and food, food and eating. Love doing
retreats. Are your workshops in person or are they virtual retreats?
So these are in-person retreats. So they're in the UK. I also do IFS constellations in the UK in person. The online.
Can you explain? We didn't touch upon that. Can you just briefly touch upon what IFS constellations is?
Yeah, sure. So constellations is a group process whereby people in the group will be invited to step into certain roles. Now, it's different from psychodrama. In psychodrama, you're kind of told what you're going to be doing. So you are this, and this is what it looks like. And you kind of play that role. Yeah. When constellations, you have a very loose sense of what you are. In family constellations, which is the original, you might come in as an ancestor, father, mother, etc. Systemic constellations, which developed out of that, you might come in as a representing a country or a company or the planet or whatever it is, nature. But in my form, we're doing IFS, so we're working with inner parts. So if the client is maybe working with their shame around drinking, for example, or they, you know, don't want to drink anymore, then they would start naming their parts, what comes up, just as you do in an IFS one-to-one process. And yes, so the initial one might be shame. Someone would come in to represent that. The part that really criticizes might come in. The part that dissociates might come in. So we start working with the parts. But the real difference is...
But in a group setting, like where other people are taking on those roles?
They're taking those roles on, yeah. Okay. So they step into it. This is the magic thing, which we can't quite explain. It's some kind of group field. And the only way I have of describing it is, you know, if you're like sitting in a cafe or something and you just feel like somebody's looking at you and you turn around and right behind you, they are looking at you. How did you know? I mean, literally, you have no way of knowing other than energetic. So there's something energetic, some energetic information that gets transferred. And by stepping into a constellation, it's as if you're plugging into the Wi-Fi code and you are now receiving the energetic information. And because there are only so many feelings, emotions, we've probably had all the emotions. It's not that hard. But knowing the right one at the right time or knowing exactly the right words to say, that's beyond any understanding, any logical understanding that somebody would say something like, God, I feel like we're twins or something. And the person goes, I have a twin. Or, you know, they say something that could be, that kind of, it can never be known. And yet here it is. It's known through some kind of energetic transfer of information. So I've seen that now many thousands of times in constellations. I trust it. I don't know how it works. It just does. So what we see in the constellation is gradually the parts start giving their information. Nobody's told what to do. The information arises. And the person whose constellation it is, so the seed person, will come into relationship with their parts and start to see how the system works and have a deeper connection with one or more of those parts for them to take on then and, you know, just kind of open as a portal to their next level of healing.
So when you do that, is this like an established group that would be all working together like on a weekly basis? So there's like a level of like trust and safety? No.
Nope. People turn up for the first time. Some people come back month on month or, you know, once or twice a year. People don't know each other. And that's part of the magic. There's no way they could have known the things that they're saying. I obviously because of what I've learned, I make a container in a certain way. So I don't do 6-7 constellations in a day. I only do a few. We have a lot of holding processes for the group to work with their own parts, their own system. Then we'll do some constellations. Then we'll close the day with everybody working with their own system again. So it's all held really safe. And again, it's about the process, not the product. It's not about the number of constellations we do. It's in any moment, everybody being with what's here for them, whether they're witnessing, whether they're participating, or whether they're having their own constellation. What's happening in me right now? Can I notice it? Can I name it? Can I bring some curiosity and compassion to it? So we're doing IFS all day.
It's in person?
In person, yeah. Every day.
Yeah, I'm taking a sociometrics and psychodrama like certification thing, and I'm trying to figure out like ways of like, how do you do some of this stuff virtually?
Yeah, I don't do constellations virtually because it's an embodied, it's a full body process. It's 3D.
So I've chosen moving around the room and walking around. Yeah.
Some people do. I prefer not to. The way I work is we're basically all constellating our own system on paper. When we're doing the drawing, we're constellating our own system on paper. And it's a different way of working. That's my choice.
Yeah. I love it. Well, thanks so much, Ruth. This was really great. And thanks for what you're doing. And yeah, I'm so glad I stumbled upon your episode with Tammy. So.
Real pleasure, Andrea. It's been great to chat to you.
Yeah, I loved it. So this is for you. Yes, you. The person that's been wanting to sign up for Breathe to Heal but still hasn't yet. Consider this your aggressive yet loving nudge towards something that's actually going to have a huge impact on the way you show up in the year ahead. And here is why. You will gain practical nervous system tools that you can actually lean on whenever you find yourself feeling dysregulated. The emotional release breathwork sessions will help you release what your body has been holding on to so you actually have some space for the good to come in. Through parts work and compassionate integration, you can get your protectors to calm the hell down so they are not running the show 24/7. Plus, this is 75 minutes each week that you're actually dedicating purely to your own healing journey. And just a reminder, if for some reason you can't make it to a session live, replays will be made available within 24 hours. So we are kicking off next week, January 13th, and we have 4 spots left. So if you are ready to make 2026 the year you actually put your nervous system first, grab your damn spot now. Head to adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. So that is adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. Breathe has an E at the end. Again, consider this your aggressive yet loving nudge.